Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event in association with the Lundberg Institute as its inaugural address. We welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce the president and founder of the Lundberg Institute, George Lundberg, who will introduce Dr. Fisher.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hammond. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming. Fellow physicians, how many of you are physicians? Raise your hand. About 20%. Fellow healthcare workers, if you work in the healthcare field, raise your hand. And maybe another 10, 15%. Fellow patients, if you're a patient. Fellow Medicare beneficiaries, raise your hand. That's about 30%, thereabouts. Fellow students, are any of you students? If you're not a student, you don't belong here. We're all students. We're students tonight in particular. The Lundberg Institute, also known as TLI, is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization in Los Gatos. It's dedicated to the credo of one patient, one physician, one moment, one decision. Let it be a shared decision, informed by the best evidence and considering cost, no matter who pays the bill. TLI works primarily through collaboration, such as tonight with the Commonwealth Club. We're very proud and even thrilled to be able to announce Dr. Elliot Fisher, who is Professor of Medicine and Community and Family Medicine at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, as the first Lundberg Institute speaker. Dr. Fisher has his BA and MD from Harvard, his MPH from the University of Washington. He's a general internist whose research has focused often from a Medicare database on regional variations and likelihood that what doctors order and is done really ought to be done or not. And his results indicate that as much as 30% of U.S. healthcare spending is devoted to services that apparently provide no benefit. Dr. Fisher, you have 40 minutes and then an active Q&A thereafter until we run out of our radio time, and here you are.
George, thank you very much. Dr. Lundberg, George, thank you very much. It is it's an incredible honor to be here. I feel both honored and lucky. Honored because many of you don't know George Lundberg, but he is a very important figure in American medicine and in my career in American medicine. So seeing some younger students out here to remind you of why it was just no question that I would come and be able to speak here. He was the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association for 17 years, and in that role, markedly increased the impact of that journal, bringing it up to the top tier of medical journals in the world. He led the effort to extend biomedical journals beyond biomedicine. So it wasn't just about which molecules. It was about smoking, about nuclear war, about the policy and practice and delivery of healthcare. He helped create the field of evidence-based medicine. So if you look back at The User's Guide to the Medical Literature, one of the series that JAMA ran, or the Rational Clinical Examination that many of us read carefully to learn how to do a diagnostic physical exam. And finally, he brought science to medical journals. Actually, there was no science before. It was about opinions of peer reviewers. And, Dr. Lundberg said, no, we ought to really bring together journal editors to understand how peer review is done. Can we improve peer review? What should the standards be for medical journals and the standards of peer review? So I'm really very, very honored to be here. I also feel incredibly lucky. So when I was in college, I had no clue what I was going to do. I majored in mountaineering at Harvard with a minor in East Asian studies, particularly Chinese. When I graduated, I really had no clue what I would do. So I thought I'd drive an ambulance in Somerville, Massachusetts. And on the ambulance, I saw kids dying of things that my friends in Cambridge, where I grew up, would never have died of. And I saw how absolutely terrible the healthcare system can be. I think the qualifications to be an EMT then were that you couldn't get a job as a security guard. So driving the ambulance, I realized that I enjoyed the clinical work and that it could be really important to think about how we're going to change this system. And I thought, maybe I'll go to medical school, and my hope was to someday be involved in health policy. And so I tell my kids, be careful what you wish for. Be careful about your dreams. They might come true. Interestingly, the problems we now face in healthcare are so much worse than they were when I was driving the ambulance or when I was in medical school. We were spending 6% of the GDP on healthcare then. We're now spending 17%. Healthcare is just as uneven in its quality in the United States now as it was back in 1974. We've had some advances in biomedicine, but we haven't translated those advances into practice for everybody. But the cost problem is really becoming the pressing problem. Brought home to me most recently reading a report of the Boston Foundation. 10 years ago, Boston Public Schools had decided to invest $1 billion in reducing disparities in public education. And they did invest an additional $1 billion in public schools. They spent $700 million of that on the rising cost of benefits for workers in the educational system. So they actually increased class sizes and cut teacher training. Disparities increased. So they titled, I think the paper is something like Broken Promise. And we know from a recent RAND study from here in California that take-home pay is falling because of the rising cost of healthcare, especially if you take into account the loans, the money we're borrowing from China, where I just was, in order to finance the increasing cost of healthcare here. So what I want to try to do tonight is a few things. First, I'll tell the story of our research and how it got us to thinking about how to reform the delivery system and the principles that we used to promote this notion of integrated and coordinated care, reinventing, you know, the old managed care in a way that might, we hope, work this time. We'll see. I'll then give you a little bit of an update on where we are in the introduction of delivery system reforms. We've learned a lot over the last 2 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And then I'll talk about what I think we need to learn. I still don't know what the answers are here, but it's where we're starting to look to try to learn some new things about how to fix this broken healthcare system so our kids have affordable healthcare. So about 30 years ago, Jack Wenberg, an epidemiologist, went to Vermont to apply the tools of epidemiology to the healthcare system itself. So epidemiology studies the distribution of illnesses in populations. He applied the tools of epidemiology to study the distribution of doctors and healthcare systems in communities in Vermont. He found tenfold differences in surgery rates across the identical communities in Vermont, and threefold differences in per capita spending. And then other people had observed variations, but Jack devoted his career to trying to get a lot of people to pay attention to it. I joined him in 86. The work on variations in procedure rates led directly to a lot of the work that JAMA has done since then and others about, you know, the variation in procedure rates are fundamentally due to two problems. One is we don't really know what the outcomes of many of the treatments that we're prescribing are, so we don't know whether they work or not. But the second and probably more revolutionary notion was that that the decision about what procedure a patient needs depends not only on the risks and benefits, but on how that patient values those different outcomes. Take the example of bypass surgery. Does reduce the incidence of chest pain, angina, after if you've got simple coronary artery disease. But it comes with a side effect. The side effect is about 10% of patients will have cognitive impairment. So the choice is, do you want to play tennis or do you want to remember your daughter's name? Wrong patient surgery is just as serious a problem as wrong side surgery. And so unless we're able to get patients' preferences right, and align treatments with what they really value, do I really want my back surgery? Do I want a knee replacement now, or should I wait? We're going to prescribe the wrong treatments for patients. And so what Dr. Lundberg is talking about in terms of evidence to patients and making decisions that are aligned with their preferences is a very important second piece of the reform agenda. Better information about what works and doesn't, and what their outcomes are. Second, better aligned treatment choices and informed decision-making and shared decision-making. The third area that I really spent most of my time working on was this question of spending. So there were threefold differences in per capita spending in the state of Vermont, and there are threefold differences across the United States. We spend three times as much per capita in Miami and McAllen, Texas, as in Minneapolis or Wisconsin. And in spite of a fair number of recent efforts to undermine those findings, the articles that have tried to do that are not very well done. And so if you look back at the original work, where we carefully controlled for case mix instead of spuriously as they are now, you see in identical patients, hip fracture patients followed in Miami compared to or in the highest spending regions compared to the lowest spending regions, what you see is those in the highest spending regions get, you know, 70% more time in the hospital, identical patients, they spend 70% more time in the hospital, twice as many physician visits, 70% more diagnostic tests, 70% more imaging services. So they're getting much, much more discretionary and potentially avoidable care, because what we learned in terms of the outcomes was that survival was actually slightly worse in the higher spending regions. More time in the hospital isn't actually necessarily good for you. So what that additional spending was going for was essentially avoidable, unnecessary care. We spent a fair bit of time after that trying to understand, so what were the causes of the variations across regions? Some of it was due to the capacity of the healthcare system. By golly, if you have twice as many cardiologists per capita, people are going to see cardiologists twice as frequently. If you have twice as many hospital beds, more time in the hospital. And the payment system we thought contributed, right? It's fee-for-service payment everywhere. So that's not, and supply only explained about half of the difference across communities. So we were puzzled. We spent a lot of time using clinical vignettes to understand how are physicians making decisions. Where there was strong evidence, they didn't differ much between high spending and low spending regions. But where judgment was required, the differences were dramatic and highly correlated with each other. So, for example, when would you next see a patient with well-controlled blood pressure? They didn't teach me that in medical school, I promise you. And what we found from our focus groups was that, is the mic on? Can you guys hear? Good. So what we found from our focus groups with physicians in Oregon, they said we would see those patients once every year, maybe every 6 months. Physicians in Sweden, by the way, say we'd never see those patients. The nurses would occasionally give them a phone call, see if their blood pressure is still controlled. But the physicians in Miami said we'd see those patients once a month. We then remained puzzled by why decisions like that were clustered regionally. If that's an individual physician uncertainty issue, it should be about how the physician's making a decision. Why should they be clustered regionally? So we dispatched a colleague from Harvard, Atul Gawande, to go look at McAllen and El Paso, Texas. And Atul discovered, you know, what many of us suspected, that there's something about clinical culture in many of these communities. That in some places, you know, patients are another way to make money. And in other places, they're simply not. The focus of the delivery system is on maintaining its financial viability, but is fundamentally about improving the health and care of the patients they serve. So the contrast between McAllen and La Crosse, Wisconsin, is one that we came to notice. So culture was obviously another very important part of this in a system where fee-for-service payment, which rewards more and gives you the opportunity to provide more, and some of it was probably fraud as well. So we came out of that work in about 2006 with a sense of what the four underlying problems were in healthcare. If we were going to fix the delivery system side, we needed to cover everybody, of course. But if we're going to fix the delivery system side, there were four things we thought were going to be important. One is we're confused about the aims of healthcare. Is it about money or is it about something more? And so clarifying the aims, and there's been good consensus on this, it's got to be about better health, better care, lower costs, what Don Berwick and now the National Quality Strategy call the three-part aim, better health, better care, lower costs, for patients and communities. So a clear aim will help us know where we want to try to go. The second problem was that we have absolutely inadequate data on the performance of the healthcare system. Unless you are measuring what's happening in the healthcare system, you can't know what's happening. We can't improve care unless we're measuring what we're doing. So the second pillar of the reform initiative that we proposed was this notion of markedly strengthening the information so we could understand the quality of care, so that if you tried to change the incentives, which I'll get to in a second, you could be sure that people were not stinting on care because you're measuring performance. The third piece of the problem, which I think is probably the most important problem, is we think of health physicians see their jobs as producing health through face-to-face encounters. And what we've learned from the quality improvement work, what we've learned from those people who brought industrial improvement initiatives to healthcare, is that it's a system. And if you pay attention to creating organizations that are capable of having a clear aim, measuring what they're doing, and systematically improving care, you can actually do it. So that's the third problem, a flawed conceptual model. We need to shift to a new model of organizations organized accountability for integrating and coordinating care toward a common set of aims. The fourth problem was our flawed financial incentives. If you have a fee-for-service payment system, it reinforces that notion that it is the individual doc, right? It's the individual nursing home. It's the individual hospital whose performance that you want to pay attention to. So it was this notion of individual autonomy, individual accountability that's rooted in the fee-for-service payment system and is the barrier to the integration coordination that we need to achieve if patients are going to get great care at lower cost. And so the fourth principle was, how can we get the financial incentives and the professional incentives, going back to that discovery about the difference between McCallum and LaCrosse, how can we get the professional incentives aligned with what we're doing, what we need to do? So where are we now? The Affordable Care Act had three sort of major hunks that each are important. So there was the coverage expansion. That's been the major focus of political debate. Very important. We must do it. Why on earth the richest country in the world can't cover everybody, and we'll have to fix our insurance system to do that. Public health improvement was the second major focus. Huge investments in improving community health under the Affordable Care Act. And the third piece was delivery system reform. And I think all of them are important, but without delivery system reform, without fixing this cost problem, we won't be able to afford to either maintain the public's health or keep people covered. So the delivery system reform work that's happened, there are a number of pieces of the Affordable Care Act that focus on delivery system reform. There are three major different payment approaches that have been proposed under the Reform Act. And I won't go into a lot of the details, but I will spend some time. One is this notion of the critical need to support primary care. And there are a number of initiatives referred to under the term medical home, which for consumers makes them think, most people in the public, makes you think of nursing homes or, worse, funeral homes. But the basic notion of the medical home model is to try to provide payments to primary care practices that support the things that are not now paid for under fee-for-service medicine. So things like telephone calls, things like group visits, things like registries, things like the tools that will allow a primary care practice to markedly improve the care they're providing, to manage a population of patients rather than have to have them all come in ka-ching, 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 for a visit to get everything done. The early evidence on medical home initiatives is very strong. They're looking very promising, especially when they're done within integrated delivery systems. And so it looks very promising. But the limitation of the medical home model is that it puts all of the responsibility for coordination on the shoulders of the primary care physician, makes them reach out to the hospital for the discharge records, makes them reach out to the specialists, and leaves the rest of the system to run its merry course. The second model of payment reform is something called episode payments. That is, if we start to pay, say, for the 90 days around a knee replacement or a hip replacement, or the 1 year after a heart attack. What you'll start to get is you'll get the hospital and the physicians all working together to try to improve care and reduce costs, because they're going to capture a share of those savings within that episode. There's some challenges to the episode payment model as well. I think it's very important. It's a good transition, but we can't be confused about whether it's going to stay, that it's going to save any money. I think there's no doubt it won't save any money. Whatever money is saved will go to the pockets of the providers with inside the episode, and there's no incentive in episode-based payment to reduce the number of episodes. There's no incentive to do informed patient choice for, so that patients are making wise choices about whether they want that particular episode of treatment or not. Which leads us to this notion of accountable care organizations, which were the third major payment idea that emerged. So when Mark McClellan left the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, he was the administrator there under the Bush administration. When he left, he joined us in starting to joined us at Dartmouth in starting to look at, are there other ways of organizing payments that could encourage groups of physicians to become accountable for the overall care of the populations that they're taking care of? We had done some work that showed, not surprisingly, that most physicians practice within natural referral networks around a hospital, maybe sometimes around two hospitals. But we actually measured that. There were about 3,500 of these natural networks that we could look at, and about 80% of the care on average in the United States is provided for patients who are cared for by those physicians and that hospital within that network. So they're already working together as a network of physicians. They just don't know it. Nor are they being rewarded for trying to work together more effectively or to improve the care of the patients they're serving more effectively. So the notion of accountable care organizations emerged from that work. The term came up, was invented at a meeting of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. Glenn Hackbarth, who was the chair, and I, in a little conversation, I had a really pathetic name for them before this, extended hospital medical staff. That really rolls right off the tongue. And so Glenn said, you know, Elliot, I don't think that's really a very good term. How about accountable organizations? And I said, let's put care in there. So let's have them accountable care organizations. Of course, my daughter has subsequently told me, and the focus groups have confirmed, that this is a really lousy term as well, because patients think accountants, and they don't want to be taken care of by accountants. I'm not surprised. So we should have called them coordinated care organizations or something like that. But we did enough work before the bill, in various efforts over the course of about a year, to convince the Congressional Budget Office to score this idea of accountable care organizations as actually saving money under the required budget standards that the Congress uses for judging new legislation. Well, if you have an idea for Congress that saves them money, what do you think they do with it? They go, yippee, stick it in. Stick it in the bill, because we'll be able to spend that money we're saving somewhere else. So of all of the reform pilot ideas that were floating around, ours included, ACOs were included as a required element, you know, a mandatory program to start on January 1st, 2012, like 2 months from now, as a component of the Affordable Care Act. Those of you who are inside baseball, inside healthcare, know that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services that is responsible for getting this program off the ground announced draft regulations for ACOs in March of this year, with a storm of opposition and anger from the provider groups, because they didn't think they were making enough money off them, and that it would have been hard. There are a bunch of good technical reasons why there were some changes that were required. And then last week, they released the final regulations for this program, which were greeted with much more enthusiasm on the part of the providers, and the consumer groups maintained their support for them as well. Because, of course, the concern, the notion of accountable care organizations is the following. First, we can figure out, we will attribute a population to the primary care physicians in your ACO. So whoever they are taking care of, if you're seeing a primary care physician, you see that primary care physician more than others, you will be attributed to that system, invisibly to you, possibly, under the legislation. So it's attribution to the primary care practices, the calculation of a target budget. We know how much it's costing you this year, that the ACO this year, to take care of those patients. Therefore, we can calculate or predict pretty accurately, especially if it's a big enough group, what it's going to cost next year. We can create a virtual budget, virtual capitation. We then have the third requirement, though, which is that to get any of those savings, you have to demonstrate that you're improving quality. And so that was the final element of the ACO model, of demonstrably improved quality, a payment model that rewards you for doing the right thing, with the providers getting a share of the savings and the trust fund keeping a share of the savings, and then performance measurement to make sure they actually are living up to that notion of being accountable. So over the last 18 months, as we've watched the emergence of this model, a few things have become clear. And I think those of us who are Dr. Steve Shortell, Professor Shortell, who's here, who's engaged from Berkeley, who's engaged in looking at this with us, and others, I've started to see gain a number of insights into how this is working in practice. Although the federal program ACO program has not formally started, there are a number of initiatives in the private sector that have moved forward. So there are over 80 organizations that have ACO initiatives going on in the private sector. Massachusetts is farthest along. We have four sites that we've been working with most closely and did some site visits to see what was happening on the ground. The Alternative Quality Contract in Massachusetts, which is an ACO initiative, ACO-like initiative run by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, now has two-thirds of Massachusetts physicians participating in a model like this. So we are starting to see some emerging evidence about at least how these things look on the ground. Not yet what their performance is, although there's some glimmerings that it looks promising. But there are a few insights. The first is this notion that it's not a contract, it's a journey. So we initially thought, when we passed the legislation, that this was going to be about just getting them to sign that damn contract, and then we could call them an ACO. What we discovered on the ground was that this is going to be an ongoing, iterative process toward ever and ever, ever more accountable care. And the contract is only one tiny piece of that. So we see, as you look across the landscape of American medicine, it's incredibly diverse. There are physicians in small independent practices starting to form an ACO who are starting from nowhere. They don't have any relationships with each other. No contract, no network, nothing like California integrated groups, nothing. Small, fragmented individual physician practices. There are hospitals that have employed physicians. There are fully integrated delivery systems. Places are starting at a huge terribly diverse set of starting points. The second thing that's very interesting is that this is emerging as a partnership model. The old model was this, head-to-head fighting, dickering over prices that the private payers had with the providers. And it was, do you want a 2% raise or a 1% raise, or if you're Sutter, a 30% raise, for those of you from California. But you're arguing about, dickering about the price. What's emerged in the ACO models with the private payers, and almost all the major health plans have ACO initiatives underway, is it really is emerging as a partnership. So the old model, managed care 1990, was about shifting risk. The plans shifted risk to the docs, many of whom went bankrupt because they didn't know how to handle it. So instead of shifting risk, you share risk. You figure out what are smart ways to create incentives for the docs to be able to manage the cost of their patients. The second, in the old days, there were no quality measures. Now there's robust performance measurement. Not as good as it could be, but there is robust performance measurement. The only rewards in the prior system were for stinting on care. And now you're only rewarded if you actually demonstrably improve care. And finally, the old model had gatekeepers. And anyone enjoy being gatekept? It wasn't much fun. Patients were scared. They weren't being allowed to go to wherever they want, the physicians or hospitals that they wanted to choose. And the new model, at least under Medicare and in many of the private plans, is choice. There may be a little steering in the private plans, but in the Medicare program there will be complete freedom of choice, which puts tremendous pressure on the ACO, in a good way, to make it attractive to get care from trusted providers. So a saying that maybe it's only because I'm from Vermont and we have relatively lousy land for grazing, but, you know, the best fence is a good pasture. You know, so, you know, if you have a good pasture, maybe your sheep won't want to wander too far. And so at least there's a hypothesis there that if we can encourage ACOs or these new organizations to really reach out to help keep their patients there. So we're working with two places in Southern California, and they're very actively refrigerator magnets, how to get care after hours, you know, how to get help when you need it. So, and there are some promising stories. So there are some challenges, and we have to be realistic that this is going to take us a while to get there. Let me talk about two that I think are particularly important. The first is there are technical difficulties. Like, this is not going to be easy. You know, there's a lot of work to be done to learn what's the right governance model. How do you put health information technology on the ground in ways that are useful to patients and to providers across sites of care? How do you do care improvement? You know, how do you do management of patients with serious chronic illness? So there are a bunch of technical issues. Groups need financial support. It requires investment up front. Medicare is doing a lot on that front in the revised regulations to provide upfront funding to poorly capitalized groups to help them start to do the infrastructure to get these things off the ground. And then I think the hardest technical problem is this notion of a mixed business model. So imagine you're under global payment encouraged to provide the best possible care, keep your patients out of the hospital, but it's only for 20% of your patients. For the rest of the patients, you're still paid for cranking them through the treadmill of fee-for-service payment. And that mixed model is going to be very hard and is hard for organizations that are trying to navigate it now. We won't see the savings that we need to see. We won't see the improved performance until it's for all of the patients in a system. So meeting today with the Pacific Business Group on health, lots of work at CMS now, Medicare now. How can we create multi-payer models so that all of the health plans are participating in a similar enough version of this that physicians and hospitals face a common set of performance measures and a common set of incentives? But I don't think that's actually the hard part. That's manageable. We know a lot about the technical side of this. The real question is this still going to be about just making money? You know, is it going to be about pocketing the change? They achieve the savings, they pocket the change. Will ACOs slip into this business model as usual? And I've been hearing stories all day about Sutter. Anyone hear from Sutter? Anyone hear from the board? I have a good friend who's on the board of Sutter, and I say this to him as well. So there are two things that I think we need to learn if we're going to achieve a sustainable healthcare system. The first is how to bring back to people working in healthcare this notion of why they come to work in the morning. You know, Peter Senge, who's an organizational development guy from MIT, wrote a book called The Fifth Discipline, which is very provocative. He currently deals with this issue of individual leadership and leadership, personal leadership within organizations by simply asking the question, so, Elliot, when I met him last, what do you stand for? And then he's quiet, which makes you uncomfortable. So you'll have to actually think about the question. So that's how can we create that sense of personal leadership? I had a wonderful breakfast this morning with 20-odd residents in internal medicine at UCSF, and it was just so inspiring to see this group of young physicians who want to make a difference, want to be providing great care, want to solve this terrible social problem that we face. So I think there is hope there. The second question, and here it's really more of a hypothesis, how can we create community structures of accountability that can make that could help ACOs to behave themselves or hospitals that are thinking about doing it just for the money? And there I'm increasingly interested in the work of Eleanor Ostrom. So how many of you have heard of Eleanor Ostrom? A couple. All right. And I saw a couple of nods. You guys just didn't raise your hands. So Eleanor Ostrom won the 2009 Nobel Prize for Economics. And she got it for solving this problem of the tragedy of the commons, or for figuring out a path forward to solving these commons dilemmas. You know, Garrett Hardin wrote the article, you know, in 1968, coining the term the tragedy of the commons. If individuals have sheep and there's a pasture, they'll put so many sheep on the pasture that they'll destroy the pasture. Self-interest trumps. Fisheries are the same. The general public policy prescription for that has been either create private property rights or have government regulated. And she asked herself the question, starting in the late 1960s, might there be a third way? And indeed there is. So she spent her career studying places like the Los Angeles Water Basin, like forests in Nepal, fisheries off the coast of Turkey. And she found some key structural elements. You know the boundaries, and you know who's inside the boundaries and appropriating the resource. That is healthcare. As Jack Weinberg showed, you know, 30 years ago, healthcare is produced locally. The people who spend the money, spend your money in healthcare, are the physicians and hospitals in your community. So we are just like a commons. The other things that were found to be relevant are capacity to convene and start to develop a shared set of aims and develop rules yourself, you the appropriators, fishers, foresters, physicians and hospitals perhaps, develop the rules that you want to be accountable for to each other about how you are going to create a sustainable resource in your community. There's monitoring, feedback, graduated sanctions. So the initial sanction is not, you know, going to jail, it's transparency. And then this notion of nested structures, that is, if you have a big resource like the Los Angeles Water Basin, you have small structures where people can look each other in the eye and monitor their performance, and you have bigger aggregations of water of at county and then metropolitan areas. There's some processes that contribute. The convening allows you to create shared aims, allows you to create trust. There's monitoring. There's a real sense of stewardship. So I think these ideas can apply in healthcare quite aptly. And let me just end with three short examples. Primary care practices could sit as a nested structure within a larger system of accountability. Mass General Hospital in Boston has a program for monitoring the practices of their primary care physicians and giving them feedback on the rate at which they order advanced imaging studies. There are fivefold differences across the docs sitting next to each other in how often they order this most expensive technology, diagnostic technology that we have. All they do is make that data transparent and facilitate a conversation among the primary care physicians in that practice. And this discussion is fundamentally about stewardship, because now they have some incentive contracts that make them all kind of responsible for doing a better job on it. So feedback and at the level of practices, I think there's a lot we could do if we bring stewardship back. At the next level up, accountable care organizations, if you imagine them, we have the Tucson Medical Center and a group of physicians in Tucson, starting from scratch, no network at all, have built an ACO in Tucson. And they're doing a couple things. First, they're buying back the advanced imaging machines, devices, from the docs. That was how the docs made money in the past. They don't need them anymore, so they're selling them to Los Angeles or to San Francisco because they know they were doing a lot of unnecessary imaging. So their cash for clunkers program, as they call it, offers you a chance of achieving real savings to the system, preventing overuse of diagnostic technology in the residents. Another example, Carilion Clinic in Virginia, one of our ACO sites, when I last visited, was having a discussion at their board about partnering with the hospital right next door, a competitive private for-profit hospital. They both have neurosurgery units. They both have open heart units. They're next to each other. So they said, let's one of us have the neurosurgery, or they were at least talking about it. Let's one of us have the neurosurgery unit. Let's another one have the open heart unit. Better outcomes for patients, lower costs for the communities. Why not? But that's where figuring out how we're going to start to manage these conversations at the community level becomes really important. And it's where I think, you know, Ostrom's notion of polycentric governance, she calls it, because the geopolitical boundaries are fuzzy. It's not just a county. It's not just a city. It's not just... And so you have to figure out how we have to figure out how we're going to create these multi-stakeholder coalitions. But they are emerging in many places around the country. The only question is whether they will be serious about trying to solve the challenge of the three-part aim. Will they really pay attention to doing everything they can to lower costs, which means consolidation, closing hospitals, figuring out how you're going to train those nurses to do something else so they don't lose their jobs and fight back. It means figuring out how you're going to improve care, not just stint on care. And it means really stepping up to the improvement work and the redesign that I think will make it possible for us to have better care for our children and have it be affordable for them. So thank you very much.
I'd like to remind our audience online and in the radio that we're listening to Dr. Elliot Fisher talking about the healthcare system in the United States. And this is the inaugural Lundberg Institute lecture. One question that comes up, I think, all the time, people have always been talking since Hillary Clinton tried to change this in the 90s, was the percentage of our GDP that is being used for healthcare. But let's just make the assumption that it's 25 years from now and that all these ideas have worked and that the incentives are in place. Wouldn't it be possible, and that we're not borrowing money to do this anymore, wouldn't it be possible for a rich society to spend more and more money on healthcare as a service? You know, I mean, it's not in of itself a. It could go up to 25% if we're rich.
It could be however much we decide. I would like to only know that the things we're spending the money on are valuable.
Yeah.
And if a third of what we're doing now, at least, is useless and unnecessary care, and we invest adequately in improving population health. Another, you know, health is produced locally as well, and there are initiatives there that we can do that would keep people healthier longer. So, yes, the thing we have to keep in mind is that healthcare is increasingly and will always compete with other ways we can spend our own wealth and our country's wealth. And most people who think about health or think about productivity think that investing more in early childhood education is a far better investment than what we're getting from investing in healthcare right now.
Great. So who would like to ask the first question?
Truly an excellent presentation. Thank you very much. Two quick questions with long responses, I guess. One of your triple aims is better health. How do you see the ACO or the whole thing integrated with the village of economics, transportation, school, and the rest? Because that's really the definition of health, not just the care model or the illness model.
The second question. Okay, I'll try to remember. This will challenge my memory, however, so I have to write that one down. Pop health. Yeah, got it.
The thoughts that you have on two issues that don't seem to be addressed, the transition between acute and long-term care and the absence of mental health in the entire discussion of the delivery system, especially when you look at the chronic comorbid conditions. So as we go across the country, we just don't hear mental health coming into the equation.
Both are great questions. So on the population health side, there is a lot of discussion about how we can do this. So David Kindig, who has done a lot of work on measuring population health, first in Wisconsin and now nationally for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, has a website that you can go to called County Health Rankings and see the social and other environmental determinants of health for your community. You know, there is conversation, at least, about we ought to have a piece of the reward for ACOs as we evolve the model for improving the health in your community. The second, and this gets to both the population health and the mental health issue, is as there's a very strong initiative underway to advance our measures of performance for these delivery systems, these new emerging delivery systems. So if we measure health risks wisely, in ways that, you know, modifiable health risks, we know from work that's being done at the University of Washington that we could probably improve life expectancy in the United States by an average of 8 years if we eliminated, you know, if we made the necessary changes to eliminate the behavioral and biological risks like hypertension, elevated cholesterol, poor exercise, and took people to even a moderate level. So huge changes could be made. And there, if we measure how effectively an ACO is doing at improving population health, that actually creates an incentive for that ACO to work with the community to say, hey, our patients can't exercise because there's no place to exercise there. Let's work together with you. But I'm betting, and this is in the work that we're doing with Ostrom's team in Indianapolis, that if we can create multi-stakeholder, polycentric governance mechanisms in communities, that what should emerge is a partnership between delivery systems focusing on doing everything they can do to improve health and other stakeholders within the community, you know, contributing as they must to improving the social and physical and biological determinants of health. So Cincinnati Children's probably the iconic, the best place in terms of its quality improvement work in the country, in terms of its ability to do it systematically across almost every element of their care. They are now engaged in community health improvement work for kids with asthma, you know, physical going after houses where they're little hot spots of asthma. The work of Jeff Brenner in Camden, New Jersey, hotspotting, identifying, you know, the local places where it is possible to intervene very efficiently to address social determinants of ill health. I think those things are important, but I don't see them really working very well without some structure to hold us all together and to start the conversation that says, Sutter, what on earth are you doing? Let's start to figure out how you can contribute to really improving the health of the population that you serve rather than pocketing another 30% increase in your margin. I may be speaking out of school here, but it's in California. I say the same thing to Dartmouth Hitchcock, so don't worry.
Two questions, too. One, with the way we've paid for healthcare over the years as individuals, with doing copays or 20%, there's been little incentive or little understanding of the costs of different procedures and no way to really shop them like you might a jacket or something.
Yeah.
And so as consumers, we haven't been trained, and there's a wide range of like what an MRI costs in different places. And is there any move to make that more transparent so that as those of us with HSAs and things could actually shop? The second question is in the ACOs.
I'm getting older, so.
So cost comparisons.
Price, yep.
The second is more integration of the use of acupuncture, mindfulness, various things. I know mindfulness has been used here in the Bayview, Health Clinic with the teens, and it's improving their immune system in response to immunizations by learning to meditate and reduce their stress. So those kinds of things as part of it.
Let me get the first one first. So the notion of being transparency on prices has some advantages and some disadvantages. First, most Americans have been trained to think that higher cost is better. So we have a cultural challenge, which is, oh, I want the high-priced colonoscopy. So what we need is good measures of value. We need to actually know that there's a certain threshold of quality that's being met by the places where if we're going to choose. California is at the forefront of this field, what's called reference pricing. Now they say here's what we think is good care and the places that provide good care at a reasonable price, and here that's what we will pay. The health plan will pay what's the reasonable price. If you want to go someplace else and pay twice as much, fine, but you get to pay for it. But I think the missing piece in that is really measures of outcomes and both functional outcomes and quality of patient's experience that give us confidence that cheaper is better. I believe cheaper is good if we can, and there's so much room to make it cheaper. Mark Smith, the president of your California Healthcare Foundation, says we have to start using the word cheaper because it's just, let's be clear what we need. We need cheaper care if it's going to be affordable for our kids. But you need quality. On the integrative care, mindfulness practice, acupuncture, there are more and more health systems experimenting with including alternative practitioners. And as you move to global payment, it creates you don't have to have someone certified on a fee schedule to be able to provide that service. If having a meditation practice in the high blood pressure clinic turns out to be helpful, systems will adopt it. I didn't talk about the transition between acute and long-term care, but it's a key piece of it. That is, everyone thinks this is not going to work unless we manage patients across the continuum. And the measure, we need better and better measures that allow us to understand that.
Well, I also have two questions.
Oh, man, you guys are challenging my memory.
So you better write these down.
Import a younger brain.
One is, why did you come up with this idea of accountable care organizations? Anyhow, when we put in the most successful payment reform, DRGs, we simply said, this is how we're going to pay the hospital for a particular admission. In Washington, it's all about cost control. You could have just simply said, you want to pay a bundle payment for a particular kind of treatment and let the healthcare system do whatever it wants to do. Why did you feel that you knew enough about the world of integrated care that you were going to push the entire United States into doing that?
Oh, so
that's
chutzpah.
One easy question.
Yeah. Right, that's the easy one, right.
And second one is, if you're successful in doing this and developing large integrated systems, which are, in fact, successful in doing what you want, like Kaiser and others, you clearly will destroy the whole notion of market competition, which is supposed to, in fact, lower costs. So you improve costs, lower them by integrating the system.
You must be an economist.
On the other hand, you destroy the competitive market in the healthcare system. So, but those two have some fun in answering those.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like
that? That's a good idea.
How did you like the play? So I think the motivation for accountable care was that, you know, administered prices, whether it was DRGs or anything, don't do anything to integrate and coordinate care. And we have about as fragmented a delivery system as you could possibly have. And I actually don't believe that we can fix the system without the kind of integration. Now, that is required to coordinate patients' care from, you know, from the outpatient practice into the hospital, back out, and that creates incentives to keep people out of the hospital. So the model, why integrated care? You know, you're in the home of the people who thought this was all a great idea to begin with. You know, Kaiser and, you know, Professor Shortell and others, all we all wrote these books about integrated care. And I will say that one of the very interesting things we're seeing in our early ACOs, we had a social psychologist with us on our site visits. And she came at the work of the site visits through the lens of identity theory, where, you know, social identity theory, where if you recognize that threats to identity are primal threats and everyone, you know, will resist anything that threatens their individual identity, and that shared identity creates influence and the possibility of collaboration and working together. What she's seeing emerging in three of the four sites was a shared identity out of being fiercely independent, you know, created out of a group of fiercely independent practitioners. So I'm not sure that everyone needs to go into, you know, behemoths of integrated employed delivery. I actually think the collaborative care model and smaller models might be right. I think if you look in Massachusetts at their emerging effort to implement accountable care organizations, it's going to be to try to keep the scale right for exactly the reasons you're talking about. We'd like to have some competition between smaller groups rather than huge Sutter, Kaiseroid. You know, you would like not to have monopolies. But I don't think I don't see a path out of this that doesn't achieve some degree of integration and coordination for patients. It may be able to be done virtually, but I don't see a path out of it. And administered prices doesn't get us anywhere near there.
Thank you for a great presentation. Many of us in healthcare have watched Dartmouth for a long time and been very appreciative of the work that's come out. I bring my question from the perspective of being a hospital administrator for 35 years. And
oh, good luck with that.
Thank you. And there's many reasons why many good ideas seem to have gone by the wayside. You know, we've been through the PROs and the QIOs and the CQI and the TQM and HMOs and et cetera. And now we have ACOs. So we have all these different things. they've all been well researched. They've all been well done. Yeah. They've all been, you know, had great hope. But many failed because, number one, we didn't give them enough time to work.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We didn't find a way to help the population understand what we were talking about. So we were co-opted by people with negative sound bites.
Yep.
And the insurance industry managed to figure out how to do us in every time. How are we going to get over those?
Well, so, gosh, it's part of the reason I am intrigued by, well, let's see. So we'll do everything we can. I am intrigued by Eleanor Ostrom's work because I think having a creating a structure of community accountability that has a safe place for those conversations offers at least one more pillar against this is just another, we're going to corrupt this model just the way we did the others. It's not going to be perfect. I am very worried about the model being stolen and used to stint on care again and consumers rejecting it again. So we have been working really hard with consumer groups to say, how can we in 2 years or 3 years be implementing performance measures that will be really meaningful to consumers and really hold these places seriously accountable? You know, I think we're at a different, I think the performance measures, both of quality but also of costs at the community level. We're working hard to say, all right, Sutter, that's fine, but we're going to out you. You know, we're going to make it completely transparent to your community how much what per capita costs are happening in your market. So businesses in your community, the Chamber of Commerce, actually start to understand. Dartmouth Atlas for over 65, they discount because it's just the over 65. The insurance plans are actually playing along to say we'll share our data if you keep our prices private and protect us from sharing them with each other. But we'll be happy to make the providers transparent so they get to go naked. And then, you know, the last thing, you know, and it really comes to the, you know, comes to the earlier question as well. So, and I'll come back to Wayne Gretzky, you know, the great one. My daughter's a hockey player.
Elliot?
You miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Shots on goal, right? Thank you for your comments. Very helpful. In terms of the last question, I think it's important we all realize that this is going to be a real marathon.
Patience.
It's managing expectations. It's taking 10 yards when you can get 10 yards. And these are very difficult times with the economy. We live in a global world now. A lot of things are different from 1994 in the Clinton era. So the insurance companies now are more a part of all of this. They've bought in or been co-opted. Nothing wrong with co-opting people with incentives. So my question is, with the rules published last Thursday and some of the changes that we know were made in that, from reducing the quality measures to the antitrust, loosening that up and a number of other things around the risk, you know, the downside risk, what are your own thoughts about some of those changes, which are more important, and will it bring more people to the starting line to start this marathon?
Well, I think the changes were almost all for the good. And, you know, of course, you should comment as well, since we probably are both writing blogs for some miscellaneous journal that, anyway, will remain unnamed until you read our blogs. I think they're a move in the right direction. I think they will bring more people to the table. I think we do have to be patient. This is, you know, we have to accept failure. We have to be prepare people that there will be organizations that fail. There will be, but you know, it's quite a different world than it was even 18 months ago. So 18 months ago, you know, the AMA leadership was, you know, busily fighting this thing, even though it was in the legislation, and really pretty opposed to what was going on. You know, now they recognize it's coming. They've gotten to acceptance. You know, and the question is how to make it, you know, how to make it work as well as it can. I think it's going to, you know, I think it's really up to us. You know, this is, we have another window of opportunity. It's here now. If I'm a, you know, I I think probably the analogy I would love to see is to the work in the intensive care unit, you know, Peter Pronovost's work and others, where once they showed that it was possible to prevent hospital-acquired infections for patients in the ICU, which we had previously believed was just the cost of doing business. You just killed 5% of your patients. You know, once we realized that that wasn't necessary, it changed the way everyone thought about safety in hospitals. And so if we can do the same thing in a couple of places, if your hospital, you know, or the Contra Costa County, or Cincinnati says, we actually can show you that we have lowered costs and improved care for patients, and the consumers are happy, the physicians and the nurses are actually having a good time at work instead of being miserable. This is a complex adaptive system. Complex systems go through tipping points very quickly. And we could have, and that would be if I were betting on anything, it would be, let's get a couple places to show it's possible. And that will really help accelerate adoption of the model, because no one will want to not be playing the game, a much more fun game, like a hockey game.
I'm with the City and County of San Francisco, and we have over 100,000 members, in employees and retirees in the city, and over 40% living in the city. We have 92% of our people in an HMO. And we're dealing with whatever every municipality is dealing with, shrinking budgets, and cost increases for our health care that are
unsustainable.
62% increase in the next 5 years is what's projected. Completely unsustainable. As of July, we launched two competing ACOs in the city of San Francisco with two fabulous medical groups associated each with different health with different hospitals. One of those hospitals is Sutter, as you're alluding to. You know, I love both medical groups. I think the doctors have always had health care and the best health care at the focus of their primary aim. I think the hospital systems with the way they're currently operating, in particular Sutter, they're operating at a 30% increase and are driving our premiums beyond what we can afford. The problem that I see, and I'll take your comment, is at this point, I can't make them compete on the free market because that's not the way the benefit is product. The product is designed.
Right.
It gets all bundled together with one price that has to go to the marketplace. And I think until we can get the DMHC, the Department of Insurance, onto the idea of ACO products,
inside,
we're not going to be able to bring that free market and allow that competition.
I think you, from my experience today, spending a couple of hours at the Pacific Business Group on Health, and you having re-imported a wonderful leader in your health exchange, Peter Lee, who used to run the Pacific Business Group on Health, this notion of creating transparency on medical group products within a health plan, I think is a very powerful idea. And Godspeed. Because right now, you know, the powerful groups just, you know, demand their discount, demand their price, and the non-powerful groups get pathetic increases in their fees. So creating transparency, I think there's still some challenges around how to do it. You know, you'd like all the health plans to, you may need to put people together, but I think it is the right direction to go. Godspeed.